Firefighters get the upper hand on a 200-acre fire that threatened homes south of Missoula last night. Good evening. I'm Connor Ballantyne.
And I'm Courtney Anderson, and that's our top story tonight on Montana Evening Edition.
Capitol reporter Dan Boyce tells us what the business heavy hitters had to say today at the Butte Economic Summit. And in our feature interview, news director Sally Mock talks with constitutional scholar Melvin Yurovsky about the value of dissent on the U.S. Supreme Court. A little overnight rain, some hard work by firefighters on the ground, and water drop from helicopters today have erased the danger posed by a 160-acre wildfire that started during a thunderstorm last night east of Lolo and just south of Missoula. The fire forced the evacuation of 60 homes in the Upper Miller Creek area last night, an evacuation that was lifted this morning. Fire Information Officer Cindy Super says the fire is a lot calmer now.
That rain was It was a good thing, and getting the helicopters in there and more folks on the ground, and it's looking really good right now.
Strong, gusty winds pushed the fire within a mile and a half of several homes in the Upper Miller Creek area last night before firefighters managed to corral it.
Like with a lot of these emerging fires, and they're going fast, one of the bigger factors we're looking at is the wind, and that was definitely at play last night. So, you know, having the winds kind of die down a little bit, start to shift around, that really gave firefighters an opportunity. And, you know, really good initial attack response with the ground forces. You know, even without the helicopters in the air, they were able to get a really good response and got some water on the fire right away, which was helpful.
The fire is a good reminder that even though it's mid-September, fire season is not over and may not be for a while.
Well, they're talking about a front coming through tomorrow and pretty significantly lower temperatures, more moisture, and so we'll see what comes with that. That's definitely something we're looking for, and also just, you know, but then it's supposed to pick back up again and be a little bit warmer, and, you know, usually we expect that there's going to be some late season fires with the curing of fuel. This stuff dries or freezes and stuff starts to go dormant, but we've got that to look forward to, and also always ask that our hunters would make sure that their warming fires are out. If they start a campfire or a warming fire while they're out hunting, make sure that it's out before they leave, because obviously it's cool in the mornings, but as we've seen the last couple of days, it can get warm pretty fast.
The fire is being managed by the Missoula Rural Fire Department and the Montana Department of Natural Resources and Conservation.
And another news from around the state, Blue Cross Blue Shield of Montana will be opening a new call center in Great Falls, adding between 100 and 150 jobs in the community. The state's largest private insurer made the announcement during a Montana job summit in Butte today. Chicago-based Healthcare Service Corporation, or HCSC, purchased the company this past summer for $40 million. Blue Cross Vice President for Sales and Marketing Frank Cody says the call center will likely serve customers in the five states where HCSC operates. HCSC cut a deal with the state regulators to preserve all 450 Blue Cross jobs in Montana. Cody says the 100 or more jobs for the call center are another part of that deal that HCSC cut with the state.
And with a lot of the changes in healthcare, there's a great opportunity for us to continue to grow the workforce of HCSC across the five states.
Cody says the call center will employ customer service representatives, billing that enrollment staff, as well as clinical staff like nurses and managers. He says he did not know what these jobs would pay, but suggests those in Great Falls should feel optimistic.
I know that HCSC pays a very competitive scale in their other states, and they have benefits to go with those as well. So we expect these to be quality jobs that will provide good incomes.
The company will be looking to fill the positions at the call center starting in the spring of 2014.
That Blue Cross call center announcement was part of a packed agenda today at the Montana Economic Development Summit in Butte. Senator Max Baucus is spearheading the event, hoping attention from some of the world's biggest names in business will foster job creation. Capitol reporter Dan Boyce is in the mining city for the two-day event and brings us more on the heavy hitters the summit has brought in.
This Montana Jobs Summit represents the best of America.
Facebook Chief Operating Officer Sheryl Sandberg sits across a small table from Senator Max Baucus on the main stage of the Montana Economic Development Summit.
This is what we need. We need great people with energy and entrepreneurship who care about equality, who care about economic growth, coming together from the private sector, from the government, and from the corporate sector.
Baucus's office says about 3,500 people are attending the summit in Butte looking to make connections. Attendees could choose from more than 40 panels addressing topics ranging from job creation in energy and the tech sector, finding jobs for vets, and fostering equal opportunity and equal pay for women. Sandberg has made a name for herself in fighting for female equality through her recently released first book called Lean In, Women, Work, and the Will to Lead. She says society still stigmatizes successful women, and it starts at childhood. Sandberg says little boys are rarely called bossy, but it happens often to little girls, and it's not fair.
So the next time you're about to call a little girl bossy, take a deep breath and say, that little girl, she has executive leadership skills.
Sandberg joins the likes of other top executives from FedEx, Delta, Google's executive chairman Eric Schmidt, and billionaire entrepreneur Elon Musk, founder of PayPal, the private space exploration company SpaceX, and Tesla Motors. Sometimes Musk's presentation strayed into the stratosphere as he spoke about SpaceX's overarching goal to build a sustainable colony on Mars.
Because I think the future of humanity is fundamentally different if we are a space-faring civilization and a multi-planet species compared to one where we are not.
He also tried to speak practically to the crowd about what it takes to make a business work. He says the Great Recession nearly sunk both Tesla and SpaceX.
While things are going really well these days, I think it's always important to remember that when you're creating a company, there are very dark times. And it's about getting through those dark times. That's the difference between success and failure.
I have innovations that could actually move SpaceX.
Musk took questions from the audience, and one of them came from a man calling himself Right On John from Right On John Innovations in Townsend. His question to Musk, what would be the easiest way to get in touch with him regarding Right On John ideas?
I do have a sheet right here with my info. If I could leave it with somebody.
Trying to make connections.
All right.
Thank you very much.
We'll get it to him.
The Montana Economic Development Summit continues Tuesday. I'm Dan Boyce reporting in Butte.
Former Montana Governor Mark Roskow says he will not run for the U.S. Senate seat being vacated by Max Baucus. The Republican said today that he has been discussing the idea with supporters over the past few months, but ultimately decided against running. Roskow said that he is encouraging U.S. Representative Steve Daines to run for Montana's first open Senate seat since the 1970s. Roskow said he thinks Daines would, quote, represent Montana exceptionally well, unquote. Daines has said he is considering a race that is so far has no announced top-flight candidates. Several Democrats have already declined runs, including former Governor Brian Schweitzer. Current Lieutenant Governor John Walsh has not ruled out a run, and former Lieutenant Governor John Bollinger said he is also considering a run.
Two people reported being raped in separate incidents at two Montana State University fraternity houses. The university emailed an alert to students, faculty, and staff this afternoon detailing the reports. MSU police responded to a report of a rape at the Sigma Chi fraternity late Saturday night. The victim was drinking with new friends at the house and reported being taken into a room and sexually assaulted by two unnamed men. Later on that night, MSU police received a report from a woman who said she had been partying at the Pi Kappa Alpha fraternity house on Friday night and suspected she had been drugged and sexually assaulted. MSU police are investigating both reports.
13 people were cited for trespassing at the end of a rally in Helena held in opposition of a coal development proposal in southeastern Montana. The cited protesters staged a sit-in along the railroad tracks in Helena yesterday. Police officers stopped the sit-in after about 10 minutes and cited the protesters for trespassing on a Montana rail link right-of-way. The demonstration targeted the proposed Otter Creek mine in southeastern Montana, which is being reviewed by the Department of Environmental Quality. The Independent Record reported protesters cited air and water quality and a contribution to climate change as their concerns with the project. Most of the coal would be hauled by train to Pacific ports and shipped to Asia. A University of Montana economic report estimated the mine could add $200 million annually to Montana's economy.
Oil spill training will be held across central and eastern Montana in coming weeks to help emergency responders deal with events like ExxonMobil's 2011 pipeline break into the Yellowstone River. The Texas oil giant is paying for the training as part of its settlement with the state over water pollution violations. ExxonMobil agreed to pay $1.6 million in cash and other penalties after the 63,000-barrel spill near Laurel fouled dozens of miles of shoreline along the scenic Yellowstone. The spill training is being conducted in collaboration with the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency and the Montana Department of Environmental Quality. The first session is scheduled for September 23rd in Livingston. The training will run through October 5th and also includes sessions in Columbus, Billings, Miles City, and Glendive.
An organization promoting sustainable land management and natural resource enhancement through collaboration highlights such work accomplished in Montana's Clark Fork Basin. Solutions from the Land Project Coordinator Ernie Shea says leaders from the national agriculture, conservation, and forestry sectors are developing policies to meet important societal needs while simultaneously creating new economic opportunities. Researching consensus among different interests isn't easy, but Shea says work accomplished in Montana's Clark Fork watershed is a model of cooperation.
Whether it's water quality challenges in the Clark Fork as a result of the mining waste that have flowed downriver for scores of years, whether it's soil health qualities, whether it's wildlife issues, endangered species issues, forest health issues, all of these challenges have manifested themselves in this part of the country. And local leaders, rather than sitting back and expecting the old approach of the past where government agencies would come in with the solution on a white horse, they said, we've tried that, and that alone does not work.
We'll have more with Ernie Shea later this week on Montana Evening Edition.
The owners of a Kalispell company that supplies northwestern Montana rock for architectural projects and landscaping is reporting a weekend theft of more than $100,000 in equipment and supplies. Glacier Stone Supply President Tony Cavanaugh tells the Flathead Beacon the thieves loaded tools, equipment, and supplies into a company-owned one-ton utility truck that had a welder, compressor, and a crane. Cavanaugh says his insurance has a high deductible, leaving it up to the company to replace the goods stolen unless they are recovered. Cavanaugh said the Stone Company and the Flathead County Sheriff's Office are notifying pawn shops and keeping an eye online for people trying to sell the stolen items. Glacier Stone is offering a $2,500 reward for information about the theft.
Constitutional law scholar Melvin Yurovsky is in Missoula to deliver the Constitutional Day Lecture at the University of Montana. The Virginia Commonwealth University professor has written a definitive biography of Justice Louis Brandeis and is recognized as a leading scholar of the history of the U.S. Supreme Court. In this feature interview, Yurovsky talks with News Director Sally Mock about why he disagrees with those justices who believe in a strict originalist interpretation of the Constitution.
The originalists believe that everything you need to know can be found in either the text of the Constitution or in the founding documents such as the Federalist Papers, and they're not interested in anything that has happened ever since. And so that the original intent is all that matters. And the story that I always tell my class is the following. In 1777, after the Battle of Saratoga, the French came to our aid in the American Revolution, and as part of the package, we signed a treaty that should France ever be involved in a war, we would protect their West Indies possessions. In 1793, France is involved in a war with Great Britain, and they call upon the United States to protect their West Indies possessions. The only problem is we didn't have a navy. So George Washington asks his cabinet what to do. Everybody's agreed we should declare neutrality because there's no way we can fulfill the treaty. And Hamilton suggests to Washington, he just issue a proclamation of neutrality. Jefferson, who's the Secretary of State, says, no, 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 you have to go to Congress. Only Congress can declare war, therefore only Congress can declare neutrality. Washington listens to Hamilton, issues the Declaration of Neutrality. Jefferson says to Madison, take up your pen, dear sir, and strike this heresy. So Madison writes a series of essays saying that Washington is wrong. Hamilton responds, they're both writing under Latin pseudonyms. And the reason I bring the story up is that Washington presided over the Constitutional Convention. Madison is considered the father of the Constitution. Hamilton was at the Constitutional Convention, and these people were there, and 6 years later, they don't know what it means. The text does not tell them. There is absolutely nothing in the Federalist, nothing in the ratifying debates, so that you can't always get what you want out of that. Justice Brennan, I think, had the right idea when he said, you take a look at what they said and you try to infer from it what that would mean for our time. And so I suppose you would call me an advocate of a living constitution.
Mm-hmm. And, of course, the originalists, though, like Justice Scalia, for example, would argue if it's so malleable, it loses its value.
Well, Scalia is now saying, and I guess he's been saying it for a while, that he's not an originalist. He's a textualist, which is a difference. For him...
Nuanced.
Well, it's more than that. He doesn't look at anything other than the text of the Constitution. He doesn't look at the Federalist Papers. He doesn't look at the ratifying debates. He looks just at what's within the four corners of the Constitution. And he's come up with some very interesting decisions based on that. One of which is he's a great believer in the Confrontation Clause. And so it was his opinion that said that when you have laboratory testing by the FBI, they can't just send you a written report to be handed in at the trial. You have to have the technician there to testify as to what it means, that the defendant is entitled to confront his accuser. And this includes people who are providing evidence.
You have written a lot about the importance of dissent on the court, and I want to read a quote from you about that. And the quote is, "The dissenters initiate the dialogue over what a particular provision should mean, and many dissents are wrong, but the dialogue is critical."
Yes, I probably did say that because I agree with that, so I must have said it. Most dissents are forgotten very quickly. Some dissents are those of pique. You know, you people don't know what you're talking about. But then some dissents are what we call the prophetic dissents or the canonical dissents. And these are the ones that ultimately went out. You know, perhaps there's a new book out called The Great Dissent, which talks about Holmes's dissent in the speech cases and how that changed the whole jurisprudence of free speech. Brandeis, in a famous case called Olmstead versus the United States, laid down the basis in his dissent for what became the right of privacy 20 years later. It's an appeal, as Chief Justice Hughes said, to the intelligence of a future day. Sometimes the dissents are, as I said, peakish. We don't remember them, but there's an awful lot of majority decisions we don't remember either. What happens on something, I'll give you perhaps a good, easy example, is in the 1940s, the Supreme Court handed down a decision saying that states did not have to provide counsel in state criminal cases to people accused of crimes, that the Sixth Amendment did not apply to the states. And Justice Black writes a very strong dissent saying that a defendant cannot get a fair trial without a lawyer. The court in that case says there are some exceptions. You know, if the defendant is not mentally competent, if it's a very complicated legal matter beyond the ken of a layman, then there should be a lawyer. For the next 20 years, every time an appeal comes up to the Supreme Court, they manage to find an exception that requires the state to provide a lawyer. Until finally, in the very famous case of Gideon versus Wainwright, the court reverses itself. And fittingly, it's Justice Black, who is still on the court, who writes the majority opinion in Gideon. So there's a dissent that kept the dialogue going for some 20 years until it finally wins out.
You've also said that, quote, "a completely liberal court would be as dangerous as a completely conservative one."
Yes. Constitution and the cases that come before the court are not easy. If they were easy, they wouldn't get to the Supreme Court. They'd be settled down below. Now, we tend to think of the Warren Court as a very liberal court, very activist court. But if you go back and look at the cases with the exception of the racial segregation cases, most of their opinions are not unanimous. You do have a conservative bloc led by Felix Frankfurter and John Marshall Harlan II, who disagree in the criminal rights cases. With the exception of Gideon, there's usually a dissenting bloc. And what the dissent does is hem in the majority from going too far.
Would you think it's inaccurate to characterize the Roberts Court under that criteria as a conservative court?
No, it is. The majority is conservative. But it would go a lot further if it didn't have the moderate block of the three women and Justice Breyer. Stephen Alito is, I think, one of the most conservative justices that's been appointed in a long time. He's far more conservative than Sandra Day O'Connor, whom he replaced. And you can see in some opinions where he is really willing to push further than the majority is willing to go. But as Justice Brennan used to say, the magic number is five. And when you're writing the majority opinion, you have to write it so that at least five members of the court, four others besides yourself, will agree with what you say. And if you go too far in one direction, you're liable to lose somebody. Now, they'll concur in the result, but not in the reasoning. So almost every judge I've interviewed or read has said the same thing. When you're writing the majority opinion, you have to be very careful. You write a very narrow opinion, keeps it full. We think of Brandeis as the great dissenter, but the majority of the opinions he wrote on the court were for the majority. And if you look at them, they're very different. They're short to the point. He's got a paragraph where he states the facts, a paragraph where he gives the legal reasoning, and a paragraph where he gives the conclusion.
Must be more fun to write the dissenting opinion.
Oh, it is. Justice Scalia has said that, and William O. Douglas said writing a dissent is the only thing that enables a person to keep their sanity here.
Well, the court is such a fascinating thing to study and to research, yeah. And I've been speaking with Melvin Urosky, who is a constitutional law scholar and someone who's done a lot of that research and shared it with us, thankfully. Dr. Urosky, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Melvin Urosky will give a free public lecture on dissent and the constitutional dialogue tonight at 7:30 in the North Underground Lecture Hall on the University of Montana campus.
Now for tonight's forecast. West of the Divide tonight should be partly cloudy with lows in the upper 30s to mid 40s. Tomorrow, look for partly cloudy skies in the morning, becoming cloudy in the afternoon. There's a slight chance of rain in the morning, then rain showers are likely with a slight chance of thunderstorms in the afternoon and evening. Highs should be in the upper 60s to mid 70s. For central Montana tonight, look for partly cloudy skies with a slight chance of showers and thunderstorms. Lows will be 45 to 55 degrees. Tomorrow calls for increasing clouds with rain showers and thunderstorms likely in the afternoon and evening, though some of those thunderstorms may produce gusty winds. Look for highs in the 70s. And in southwest Montana tonight, look for partly cloudy skies with a slight chance of showers and thunderstorms and lows 45 to 50 degrees. Tomorrow, look for increasing clouds with a chance of showers and thunderstorms. Highs should be in the 70s. And now for the editorial comments of Julia Altimus.
Two recent opinion articles in a local newspaper highlighted the fact that Montana's forest products industry continues to suffer from two tails of one industry. The first article opined that throwing billions more at logging was wrong and went on to suggest that parroting of Bush-era Healthy Forest Initiative propaganda is nothing but a smokescreen for more corporate logging. I guess this soundbite plays well, as it is a label the author uses quite frequently and loosely. I don't even know what corporate logging means. The author is equally guilty of stooping to use propaganda to misconstrue and paint a picture in the mind of the reader. A couple days later, another opinion piece appeared in the local paper from a certified forester. He and his wife are visiting our beautiful state from the East Coast. He commented on the magnificence of our landscapes and how lucky we are to live here. It is an outdoor paradise. He went on to say, in our travels, we saw several large sawmill operations, and these mills were located in the midst of high traffic, outdoor, and recreational economies. It appears timber harvesting can and is compatible with that paradise and helps keep it alive and economically sound. French philosopher and writer Voltaire once wrote that when men argue, nature acts. That was as true 400 years ago as it is today. As we continue to argue about active or passive or no management at all of our public lands, argue about the effects of climate change on the environment, argue whether America's wood products should come from public forest management or loggers should be employed to harvest trees, nature is acting, and acting with a vengeance. It is true for centuries, nature kept North American forests in balance prior to European settlement. However, this balance was upset when people and cities start inhabiting the landscape. Centuries later, it would be ludicrous to ask everyone to leave. So our job as good stewards is to mimic the role of nature as best we can. Until the last few decades, our national forests did not grow overly dense because the natural role of fire was replaced with a program of forest thinning. Forests were logged to provide wood products and recreational opportunities, resilient ecosystems, and to prevent wildfires. Even though forests offer many important intrinsic values and experiences, managing the growing stock by harvesting trees, Congress treats wood fiber as a commodity, just like grain, cattle, and so on. That is why the U.S. Forest Service, as an agency, is under the Department of Agriculture, not the U.S. Department of Interior, like the National Park Service. When environmental groups started organizing in the 1970s, logging became unpopular. During this time frame, harvest on national forests plummeted 84%, from 12 billion board feet per year in the 1980s to half the amount in the 1990s, and has sunk to an all-time low of about 2 billion board feet annually in recent years. As men argue, nature acts. Our national forests produce 8 times more new growth each year than is harvested. The result of decades of arguing is a massive overgrowth, and with warmer climates, a tinderbox, when ignited, leaves a moonscape where there was once a paradise. The two tales of one industry is that logging leads to more deforestation of our dwindling old-growth forests, and that logging as a solution to wildfire is at best a myth. That is one tale. The other tale is forests are not static environments. Trees keep growing and must be thinned in order to promote and protect healthy forests. This process provides jobs and economic stability to local communities. The people that comprise Montana's forest products industry believe they are not only compatible with outdoor and recreational economies, these economies are dependent upon healthy forests and interdependent upon the work this industry provides. On behalf of the Montana Wood Products Association, I am Julia Altimus. Thanks for listening.
Julia Altimus is one of several commentators on Montana Evening Edition. The views expressed do not necessarily represent those of the station. If you have a comment, you can send it via our webpage at mtpr.org or on Montana Public Radio's Facebook page. Montana Evening Edition is also archived on our website. I'm Courtney Anderson.
And I'm Connor Ballantyne. Thanks for listening, and please join Edward O'Brien tomorrow at 7, 8, and 8:30 for Montana Morning News.